When the debate over the proper use of forests in the Northwest hit their most strident, the U.S. Forest Service stood right smack in the middle, and uncomfortably so. That arm of the federal Department of Agriculture acted too much like a tree farm in the eyes of conservation groups and too much like a national park in the eyes of timber groups. Just ask Jim Furnish. He was working in the Forest Service then. Now he's on the outside working as a forest consultant and launching his memoir, Toward a Natural Forest, from Oregon State University Press just this week. He's in Ashland for some launch events, and he's here in the studio to talk to us about his book. Jim Furnish spent 34 years with the Forest Service, starting as a seasonal employee, rising to forest supervisor in the Siuslaw National Forest in Oregon, and retiring as deputy chief of the Forest Service. So, Jim Furnish, a long, long bit of experience here. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Happy to be here, Jeffrey.
So, way, way back, what led you to work for the Forest Service in the first place?
I think I was like a lot of Forest Service employees. I had a love of the outdoors, kind of tagged along with my dad doing whatever he did, excuse me, and just came through high school, entered college, started off in engineering. That was not going well. Decided I'd switch majors, hit my stride with forestry, and really look forward to a life outdoors.
Your first job apparently was in the Tiller Ranger District. Is that the Umpqua National Forest?
Yeah, Umpqua, just way back up the South Umpqua River, southeast of Roseburg.
Doing what?
I was on a timber crew laying out clear-cut units in native timber.
You tell us in the beginning that the book is about two transformations. One is of the Forest Service itself. Can we assume the other one is yours?
Yeah, good assumption. I reflect back. I really became a changed person over the course of my career. Started out, I think, accepting without reservation what the Forest Service was asking and the training that I got. It was really a timber culture. And then over the course of time, I began to question and challenge. And I think the real transformation occurred for me on the Siuslaw National Forest in the 1990s.
Where you had a chance to put some of the new principles of forestry and ecosystem management into effect?
Well, I was certainly driven by circumstance because the Forest Service had been involved in losing litigation over the northern spotted owl, and that really shut down timber harvesting in the Pacific Northwest. This really was a driver of change. President Clinton, very shortly after he was elected, came and asked that the agencies create a forest plan for the Northwest. They did that. So in the space of a couple of years, there were dramatic changes. And the Siuslaw was right in the bullseye with owls and salmon, later marbled murrelets. All of these had dramatic impacts on our ability to continue harvesting timber. We stopped and really had to retool. And I think it was largely through that crisis that I came to a real fundamental change, I think, in my views of what would work in our public forests.
You know, for the last several decades, the Forest Service gets little love. And in fact, you were remarking about the web blurb we put up that said, did anybody love the Forest Service back around 1990? I wonder if it's doing its job. It's sort of like the journalist's job. If you're getting nasty phone calls from both sides, you probably did your job right. And I wonder if that's the way it can be for the Forest Service, too, is that if everybody's unhappy, if you're doing your job right. Was that sometimes the way you looked at it?
Well, I will tell you, that was the way the Forest Service looked at it. That axiom was often quoted. If you're getting hate mail from both sides, you must be in the middle and doing well. I actually came to question that wisdom a little bit. And I think that our experiences on the Siuslaw National Forest determined that there really was a different and better way. I think we've learned, fortunately, to bring a lot of sides together in common cause, where I would say the management occurring on the Siuslaw National Forest and a general shift that's occurring is certainly bringing a greater level of harmony and peace. But, back in those days, it seemed like everybody hated the Forest Service. The Forest Service was internally, I would describe, a very beleaguered foxhole, kind of head down, moving forward, but really not feeling the love.
You described some pretty difficult times and difficult conflicts and things even within the agency, particularly when you arrived at the Siuslaw, which we'll certainly have time to get into later. Some of the things that you bring up just factually in the book, that things we never realized before, like you point out the year that timber cutting hit the peak in the national forests?
Was 1989.
Yeah.
And I think this is after a couple decades of increasingly heated confrontation and conflict over timber harvest levels. It indicated to me an agency that was just moving forward with their agenda and had little time for, I think, really exploring the dimensions and depth of the conflict to really stop and consider that maybe there was something fundamentally wrong. And then it just abruptly terminated with Dwyer's injunction against timber harvesting in Spotted Owl Country.
It was a federal judge's ruling that just said, forget it.
Stop. Yeah, I mean, I would liken this to driving on the freeway at 80 miles an hour and then hitting a brick wall. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just there was no slowing down. There was no looking for an off-ramp. It was just a collision.
So was anybody particularly surprised by either the ruling or the Spotted Owl listing? They were right around the same time, right?
You know, I wasn't in the leadership of the Forest Service at the time, and I would have been very interested about those conversations between the Forest Service leaders and their attorneys with Department of Justice about their hoped-for outcome. I don't think they expected the judge to state, as he did, that the agency leadership had willfully violated the law. That hurt.
I can imagine it did.
That really hurt. But, yeah, they pretty much lost the whole enchilada. And I don't think they were looking for that sweeping a judgment against the agency.
Much more to talk about with Jim Furnish about what happened with timber cutting in the early 90s and where the Forest Service regrouped from there. His book is Toward a Natural Forest, The Forest Service in Transition. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. On the way to the break, let me remind you once again, it is Spring Fund Drive time here on the Jefferson Public Radio Services. We hope to hear from you with a pledge of support very soon. 888-552-6191 or online at ijpr.org. Back with Jim Furnish and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jim Furnish, now retired from the U.S. Forest Service. He was once the deputy chief. He was the supervisor in the Siuslaw National Forest, held many other jobs, and he goes chapter by chapter about those jobs in his memoir, Toward a Natural Forest, The Forest Service in Transition. Jim's period at the Forest Service completely overlapped the most ardent of the battles of the timber wars of the late 80s and early 90s, and went on from there to get to where he thinks is a better place for the Forest Service. He'll be speaking in Ashland tonight, brought in by Geos Institute to talk about his book with a video screening as well. That'll be tonight at 7 at the Meese Auditorium in the Art Building on the corner of Siskiyou Boulevard and Indiana Street in Ashland on the corner of the Southern Oregon University campus. People have been asking about parking already. Park near the library, the art buildings, otherwise on Indiana Street. 800-838-3760 if you want to join our discussion with Jim. You can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We talked about the fact that your first summer job was in the Umpqua National Forest in the Tiller Ranger District. You went to college at Iowa State, but then your first full-time Forest Service job was not in the West at all, it turns out.
No, that was Maine. That was a rude awakening.
In Maine.
Yeah, for a young man who was determined to go West, this was the wrong direction. And I was pretty bitter about that, I remember. I should have felt a lot better about just having a job. Worked there for 3 years. Actually grew to love Maine. And I've been back many times on vacation. It's a very special place. But after that, I started there in 68. In 1971, I came out to the Black Hills. And so I was in the West at last.
Was Maine your first look at large-scale industrial forestry? You mentioned that you'd worked in Oregon in the summer, certainly. So
yeah.
It sounds like you had some exposure here.
Yeah, Maine was it's called the Pine Tree State. It's big timber country. Almost all of Maine in the Northwoods is commercial timber forest land, very little, if any, public forest. And, boy, I'll tell you, this is industrial-scale logging. It was kind of a rude awakening. They just creamed that country back there. Fortunately, there's enough growth that, you know, the growth kind of keeps up with timber harvesting, but it was a real first taste of big-time commercial logging.
Is it plantation-style monoculture forestry?
They don't have to plant much in Maine. The soils and rainfall regimes are pretty much, they rely on natural regeneration. But typically what happens, at least in my experience, a lot of times you take out the really good stuff and it's replaced by not very good stuff. So over time, sometimes the quality of the forest is diminished.
Did you notice similarities between what you had already seen in Oregon working to plot out clear cuts in the Umpqua and what you saw in Maine?
Well, the scale, I mean, both involve big-time logging. I did get the impression, having worked in Oregon, that the Forest Service strived to be a little more thoughtful about, you know, taking care of the woods and much more careful, I think, in their road construction. It occurred to me later that the just kind of big-time assault of clear-cutting extensively through the Cascades, ultimately, after another 30 years of that, a lot of the wheels started to come off. I concluded that this was not a very sustainable approach to public land management.
Grab your headphones. We have a phone call for you. Let us talk to Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Furnish, the author of Toward a Natural Forest.
Good morning, Jim. Looking forward to reading your book. I'd like to ask two questions. The first one is, did you see a lot of people, as they moved up the career ladder, bouncing back and forth between the timber industry and the Forest Service at either the line level or the managerial level or the executive level? That's one question. And then the second question is, did you see that at the BLM? And I'll take my answers off the air. Good luck with your presentation tonight. And, guys, good luck with the fund drive.
Great. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it. You ever worked for the BLM yourself, did you?
No, I did not. Okay. I've worked with and around BLM, particularly more later in my career. Mm-hmm. Well, a couple thoughts. I didn't see much interchange between Forest Service and private industry. Most of the people that I knew and worked with in the Forest Service started out in the Forest Service, stayed with it their entire career.
They're career track kinds of people. It's not a revolving door like with regulatory agencies.
No, there was a little bit of that, but pretty rare. Mm-hmm. Most of what I did see is that people that left the Forest Service that would go to work for timber industry, but not vice versa. The Forest Service and the timber industry have what I would call a somewhat prickly yet collegial relationship. It's somewhat symbiotic. They rely on one another to get work done in the woods. But in my experience, it was always prickly. And then as far as the BLM goes, that, you know, they don't have much timberland except here in Oregon. And of course, we're kind of in the hotbed of BLM timberlands down here in Southwest Oregon. I would say, again, there was generally not much interchange between Forest Service and BLM. I think they have a reputation for probably being a little bit more pro-logging these days than is the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm. Okay, certainly with the Western Oregon Plan revision and some of the other things that have come down the road in recent years.
Yeah.
BLM, and of course, there's an additional political pressure on the BLM lands to produce from the Oregon and California Railroad lands, because those are set up to provide... at least it's set up by legislation in the 20th century by Congress to provide funding for the counties.
Yeah, you know, that 50% deal where they seem to be determined to do a lot of commercial logging, and that 50% of this revenue goes back to the counties. I've actually scrutinized that language from the ONC Act pretty carefully, and I draw a little bit different conclusion, that there's a great deal more discretion involved in working that out than I hear from the BLM. They view this as a mandate. I view it as an opportunity.
Really? So
yes.
It's not quite as locked in stone like you must cut the way it tends to be characterized, certainly by the people at the Association of ONC Counties, who are generally county leaders.
Yeah, well, I think they've been interpreting that way for a long time. But actually, if you go back and read the actual language, and I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me, but I think there's a lot more discretion available to the BLM.
We have an email here from Sean, no town given, and he probably is combining what we're talking about here about your career with our earlier discussion in the first hour about potentially reclassifying the spotted owl from threatened to endangered. But he writes, for the past 20 years, federal logging has declined right alongside the spotted owl. If federal logging remained constant or increased while spotted owl numbers decreased, then one might make a correlation with federal logging and the decline of the spotted owl. But this is simply not the case. Both have declined together, so no correlation can be made to blame federal logging on the spotted owl decline. He goes into some further for detail here, but I'm just curious to know what your what your off the hip reaction might be to that.
Number one reaction would be the advent of the barred owl, which has now invaded the spotted owl country and is out competing the owl. In fact, preys on spotted owls as feed.
Really?
Yeah. And so that was unknown back when the owl plan was first released. I think the that surprise is probably the leading cause now of losses in numbers of spotted owl. The other thing I think we have to keep in mind is we have 40 years of dedicated clear-cutting of spotted owl habitat before the protections, and the legacy value of those insults to the environment have a long life. And so I think the habitat ramifications still are with us. But I do think the most prominent cause of spotted owl declines today is the barred owl.
You think without the barred owl and the reductions in logging that we might actually have seen an increase in spotted owl numbers by now? Or
well, at least I would have hoped for stability, yeah, that the owl declines might have stabilized and begin building for improvement. One school of thought is that the best way to get the barred owl and the spotted owl to cohabit together without the barred owl just out competing is to have more mature forest habitat for both.
Jim Furnish is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a long time, 34 years career with the Forest Service behind him. He was he was the deputy chief of the Forest Service when he left. He's written a memoir about his time there, which completely overlaps the period when the spotted owl rose to prominence. His book is called Toward a Natural Forest, The Forest Service in Transition. He'll be speaking again tonight at 7 o'clock at the Meese Auditorium in the Art Building on the Southern Oregon University campus in Ashland, brought to town by the Geos Institute, where he's a board member. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760. Anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So as far as your career and the way we track it in the book, we talked about your spending time in Maine. Then you went to the Black Hills National Forest. And back then, that was quite a position within the Forest Service about fires and what their value was, if any.
Yeah, it was very interesting. The Black Hills was a real fire forest, a low elevation ponderosa pine, a tremendous amount of lightning in the summertime. And so this was really a forest that was well adapted to fire. Our approach was make sure fire doesn't happen. So we were very, very aggressive about fighting fire and excluding it from the landscape. That works for a while, but the Black Hills has had some really huge fires since then. And trying, I think, eventually to evolve management systems that actually accommodate some fire rather than completely exclude it.
And how hard is it, I wonder, to be able to implement that, particularly when you've spent decades upon decades just putting them out as best you can, forestalling them, stopping them short, all that stuff, and you end up with woods that end up overstocked? That's often the claim made about fire-prone forests where fire is not given free rein. So then how do you make the transition, though? Because if you do start burning in those conditions, you end up with unbelievably hot and catastrophic fires.
Well, for a lot of your listeners that live in or near ponderosa pine country, if you slip over to the east side of the Cascades where you start seeing a lot more ponderosa pine, I would describe it simply as this. The big mature yellow bellies, the big ponderosa pines, these are, in my view, the anchors of ecosystem health. Tragically, when you're managing for timber, those are the first to go because they're the most valuable. Conversely, they're also the most valuable for ecosystem health. So I think you have to transition to a management system where you retain the biggest and best of the ponderosa pines that can survive ground fires and provide seed for the young forest to come in. And systematic elimination of the biggest and best ponderosa pine, I think, dooms your systems to failure.
Now, they have made that transition to that on the east side forest, haven't they? I mean, what's the figure now? 16 inches diameter breast height, nothing above that gets cut?
Well, this to me would evoke some of these images of the Forest Service in transition. If you go back 40 years, this would have been seen as heresy from Forest Service timber views, and yet today they're learning. They're learning how to cope.
We can take a call here from Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Furnish. His book is Toward a Natural Forest.
Thank you. You just partially addressed my first question, which is, can you just impose a substantial fine for large log removal. So people running out with it, oh, it's only about 4 inches over, nobody will notice. If it cost them $5,000 per log to do that, I think they would be much more judicious about their, oh, I think we can get away with this attitude. And then my second question would be, is there any possibility of imposing a tariff so that instead of exporting our large logs, they are processed here? That would make so much more sense to me than sending them overseas. Thank you very much, and good luck.
All right. Thanks, Grumpy John. Appreciate that. So the first part was whether you have people who cheat and just take trees that were slightly larger than what they were supposed to take.
Yeah. Well, you know, John didn't sound that grumpy. Thanks for being kind this morning. The Forest Service actually has a very well-defined system of damages when people trespass or steal logs or cut logs that they're not supposed to. I would say it's not $5,000 a tree. But it's fairly substantial, but it has to be fair and legal. I think it is a deterrent, but obviously because some theft still continues, it doesn't stop it. It does diminish it. The second, relating to tariffs, there actually is a provision that precludes export of federal timber.
No federal timber goes overseas uncut.
Right. Private timber, that's a different story. And I think there the global market and the free market tend to reign. There is a lot of export timber, and it's just a matter of commerce. If that's where timber producers in Oregon are going to get top dollar, it's gone.
Peter DeFazio, the representative for Southwestern Oregon, once talked about invoking some previous legislation indicating a scarcity of something, and at that point you can declare that this can no longer be exported. He hasn't talked about that, I think, in more than 20 years. But
yeah.
there was that was broached at one time. I remember that much.
Yeah, and I will confess that this is really not my area of expertise. I think it is a provocative issue because typically when you send an unprocessed resource overseas, you don't get the benefit of jobs and value-added manufacturing at home. It's been talked about for a long time, but it's still an issue.
Another call for Jim Furnish toward a natural forest. Here's John and Vanita. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeff and Jim.
Hi.
Jim, I go back to the early 70s and worked for the Willamette, worked for fire control, and eventually ended up initial attack, hell attack.
Yeah, okay.
And I got to look down and see a lot, and I watched this wholesale rape. I am a fifth-generation Oregonian. My family's all loggers, and it was killing me to see the last of this, and I emphasize the term virgin to stay away from all that twisted language, coming down so fast. And, by the way, thank God that Dead Horse Rim was saved, and we got some of those yellow bellies, you call them. But I always wondered, it took me years to really get my head around it. I was quite young then, I was in my early 20s. It kind of offends me now when I look back and they're busy dumping money down in Vietnam and just taking this money, the government taking all this money and doing things with it, that they couldn't have at least set up like a small percentage trust of anything that was brought in for maintenance. So they're not closing down, basically decent roads, are keeping the culverts up and all that for the erosion, which, up in this country here, well, Saisaw too, is steep, really steep.
Oh, yeah,
you've got to stay on top of it. But I just want to ask you if anybody had ever talked about that in your tenure or when you were there.
Trust funds for maintenance, you mean?
It didn't happen. It just seems so obvious and simple.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for that, John.
Well, there's a simple answer and then probably a more complicated one. I, too, when I first went to work on the Umpqua in 65, I would say the forests were largely uncut. Problem being when you keep cutting, you come back 20 years later and they're mostly cut. So this slow but inexorable conquering of the native forest that you observed is very real throughout much of the American West. The Forest Service actually does have a fund. It's called the Knutson-Vandenberg. This dates way back to the early 1900s. It allows him to retain some of the timber money to put back into the land. It was typically for very specific purposes, like replanting. The idea of a general fund to reinvest in the land for restoration or something like that, it's proven very difficult to claw back enough money to deal with a lot of the effects that we now see to salmon, streams, roads. And that continues to be a challenge to have enough money to address all the things that need to be done.
I'm trying to figure out, in your Forest Service career, was it when you were in the Black Hills that somebody first broached the idea of maybe we shouldn't be doing quite what we're doing with timber production?
You know, I didn't hear much in the way of reservation probably until I started getting wind of this probably when I was in the national headquarters around 1990. The famous Jeff DeBonis letter, who was actually another lowly forester on the Willamette National Forest, wrote a real broadside to the chief of the Forest Service that really exploded.
And he ended up creating the Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics?
Exactly.
All right, we'll talk more about Jeff DeBonis and much more of what happened in the so-called Timber Wars of the early 90s with Jim Furnish, longtime veteran of the Forest Service. His book is Toward a Natural Forest. We'll come back and take some more phone calls for him. And in the meantime, implore you to make a phone call with a pledge of support to Jefferson Public Radio so that we can continue this spring fund drive and conclude it tomorrow night successfully. We stand just short of $104,000, hoping for $190,000 by the time we're done. Please call your pledge to 888-552-6191 or ijpr.org. Back with Jim Furnish and you in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jim Furnish, a 34-year veteran of the U.S. Forest Service, now retired from there. He retired as the deputy chief after working through a number of jobs, including as the supervisor in Oregon's Siuslaw National Forest, where he's able to implement some of the changes that came about through the Northwest Forest Plan. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, around the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So here again, a couple of different national forests. You worked in the Black Hills, the Bighorn National Forest, and then you went off to national headquarters. But it sounds like even before you got to headquarters, there might have been the beginnings of knowledge that, like, gee, these forests don't respond very well, particularly the higher elevation ones, when we cut the trees out of them.
Well, I first saw that, I think, on the Bighorn National Forest. We had done some clear cutting right near timberline. We really struggled to get trees to grow back. Went down to the San Juan National Forest, many of the same experiences there. Began to see a pattern of forests that really got ambitious about timber and logging. After World War II, new sawmills moved in. The environmental conflict started. Sawmills started closing down. Just a lot of social, economic, environmental upheaval.
That's a real key historical point, though, and I want to emphasize that because it's a big one to understand, both in this book and in history itself. The fact is that a lot of these operations did spring up after World War II when the Levittowns of the world, where I grew up,
yes,
were being created.
And the U.S. as a whole, I'd say, was just hungry for construction-grade materials, lumber and plywood, and private timber industry did not have enough land to supply it. So the National Forest kicked in as the big treasure chest of timber after that, and had a good 40-year run of really dramatic logging on our public lands.
And I remember hearing from people in the timber industry in the late 80s complain to the Forest Service, like, you guys got us into this business. You know, you invited us in. And now you're slamming the door on us.
And they were invited in. They were invited in. But I think inevitably when your mission runs counter to emerging public values and sentiments, something has to change. And change it did. This environmental movement and the conflict over logging on public lands emerged in many places in the late 70s and really just exploded in the 80s. What's interesting about Oregon was I think Oregon tended to be the nerve center of that conflict, and the spotted owl particularly is the icon of controversy.
It seems like the place where the timber industry is such a big way of life would be ground zero for that kind of battle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how heavy were the politics? I mean, and how much were you aware of them down at the Ranger District level and below? Because, for example, you talk about a Reagan appointee atop the Forest Service around in the late 80s seeking to double the harvest.
This was John Kroll. Mm-hmm. He was the Undersecretary of Agriculture. He had been an attorney for Louisiana Pacific Corporation. At this point in time, the Forest Service was harvesting about $11 billion. Remember, memos came out asking the Forest Service to show how they were going to achieve a $20 billion board foot harvest. So if you think of what was going on the forests throughout the West in the late 1980s and doubling that, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Really? That's an amazing figure to think about. We have another call for you. Let's go to Don and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Furnish, the author of Toward a Natural Forest. Don, you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, Don.
I have a specific question for you with your experience in Maine, which we depend on for hard maple. And
yeah.
Could you give me an estimate for the sustainability of that tree? Is that fast growing enough, and are they taking care of it so that they can sustain their production of it?
A lot of what I saw as a very young forester in Maine, as I walked around the woods, was that Maine grows good hard maple, sugar maple. And so you'd see a lot of evidence of big, mature maples. These were really the target of much of the high-end logging that they would really go after, both for veneers and other quality wood products. Those trees took a long time to grow. And if they were, in a sense, mined out of the forest, it took a long time for them to come back. They did regenerate naturally, and they grew quickly. But the whole concept of growing a big, mature, high-value sugar maple takes a lot of time.
How long do it take to get it to something like a usable size?
Well, that might take 180 years.
Really long cycle.
Yeah.
For a maple, where it's like, 40 years for ponderosa pine?
The 40 years in a ponderosa pine would grow you a good, young, harvestable tree. But even ponderosa pine, I'd say, begin to, quote, flex their muscles environmentally when they start getting in excess of 200 years old.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So long periods here. And that's the thing is, I mean, I remember you heard this a lot, I'm sure, when you were at the Forest Service, but from environmental groups, it's like, hey, this isn't a tree farm. But, I mean, when the process has been going on since the post-World War II period of inviting timber industries to come in and take out the trees and go make 2x4s and build lots of houses, that's a hard mindset to reverse.
Well, it is. And I think at least my impression as an impressionable young man when I first started working on the Umpqua National Forest in the mid-60s was the basic mission of the Forest Service was to log and put out fires. We did other things. You know, we did other things. We built trails and campgrounds. But the two main missions were logging, putting out fires. And if you wanted to get ahead in the Forest Service, you had to excel in one or both of those areas.
Those are the ways to be good.
Yeah. So a lot of the leadership tended to be somewhat self-selecting around people that achieve those missions.
But you mentioned that in the book that as far back as 1970, there was a report criticizing the Forest Service and its approach to things.
Well, yeah. The Boley report, this was by the dean of the School of Forestry in Montana, on the Bitterroot, was a blistering expose of some of the timber practices there. Later on, the Monongahela National Forest, the Isaac Walton League filed a suit. Interestingly enough, if you go back to the original Organic Act of 1897, required the Forest Service to individually mark the trees for cutting. Clear cutting did not do that, and this was really one of the turnstones of the Monongahela lawsuit, which the Forest Service lost. Ironically, Congress swung into action in a bipartisan way, very swiftly created the National Forest Management Act of 1976, and this was fostered the era of forest planning.
And it was while you were on the Bighorn that the NFMA came into effect, it sounds like.
It was a 1976 act, and I arrived on the Bighorn in 1977, and we very quickly began creating a forest plan for the first time.
Was that a tricky bit? I mean, you're talking basically two generations then of employees who had gotten used to doing things the same way. And so this is, well, as you mentioned, 80 miles an hour hitting a brick wall.
Well, and the one of the requirements of forest planning was that it be a very transparent, open, participative process with the public. It also, I think, became pretty clear that if the agency's mission was to cut timber, these plans became the anvil on which timber agendas were hammered out. And so even on the Bighorn was a small timber forest, but boy, they were trying to extract every bit of timber they could. And that was replicated throughout the Western United States on plan after plan after plan.
You are quite out in front in the book about your love for the landscapes that you manage. You really have a real sense of connection to the land. And so given that, it's really hard to imagine, and you give us a nice jarring transition in the book where you're emerging from the Washington subway to take your new job at headquarters in D.C. What was that like?
Well, of course, that's a completely different environment. I do think the phenomenon of people that work for the agencies falling in love with the land they work on, that's very common. Everybody likes to think that their particular national forest is the best and most beautiful. Yeah.
And so it was when you were at headquarters, was it, that Jeff DeBonis formed what was then called the Association of Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics, AFSCE?
Well, that was the result. But what started the whole process, he wrote an open letter to the chief of the Forest Service. And Jeff had been in, I think, Honduras or one of the Central American countries with Peace Corps. And he was really struggling ethically with what he was being asked to do as a timber forester on the Willamette National Forest. Boy, he tattooed everything from excessive road building to clear cutting to the effect this was having on salmon streams. And the letter was basically ignored for about 9 months before the chief wrote him a reply, kind of patted him on the head and more or less said, "You just don't understand." Then Jeff went on to create, yes, the new organization, an Association of Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics.
Which, as you point out, was a bit of a thorn in the side of the folks atop the forest. It's like, hey, like we have no environmental ethics to begin with.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so you got a chance to come back out of D.C. headquarters and come back to Oregon and try out new techniques. But it sounds like your initial foray into the Siuslaw National Forest was not a terribly happy one.
No, it was. We were just in the death throes, I would call it, of knowing that the road we had traveled down, clear-cutting mature timber, was a dead-end street. The blueprint of the forest plan that emerged out of the owl crisis clearly signaled a dramatically different future, but we had to invent it. We didn't really know how to get there. The 1990s became, in a sense, an unfolding of that journey. Of figuring out how to work in the woods, absent clear cutting and all that kind of thing. It was tough, but fascinating. Ultimately, gratifying.
You're right about loss and potential gain. So this is the loss of the old Forest Service, and in your opinion, has it reconstituted itself? Is it close to complete? Is it anywhere near that?
Well, things are very different today. That the old Forest Service is gone. I think it's gone forever. And it had many good things about it. Real sense of family, strong consensus around what our job was and that kind of thing. And some of those kinds of things are gone. My biggest criticism, I guess, I think the Forest Service is having a hard time saying yes to their future. I still see the Forest Service today, even 25 years after the kind of the closure of the past, struggling to really determine who they are, where they're going, commit to that, embrace it, and get comfortable with it and move forward. They still seem to be itchy and uncomfortable with who they are, what purposes they're striving to serve. And I felt like we found that sweet spot when I was on the Siuslaw National Forest. And it's really kind of the nature of the title of my book, Toward a Natural Forest. I think that's where the future lies. If that memoir had been written back in 1970, it would have said Toward a Commercial Forest. But today, I think it's Toward a Natural Forest. That's the future and destiny I hope the Forest Service can cleave to.
You're an excellent guest. You actually give the title of your book as you close, Toward a Natural Forest, The Forest Service in Transition. Jim Furnish will be at a special video screening and book release tonight at 7 at the Southern Oregon University Meese Auditorium that's in the Art Building at the corner of Siskiyou Boulevard and Indiana Street, brought to town by Geos Institute, for which he's a board member. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeffrey, I want to say everybody who's been seeing this video raves about it. It's a wonderful video. I really hope people come out. Thank you.
Okay. All right. That'll be tonight. Jim, again, thanks so much.